This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Truth and falsehood and the war in Iraq. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Republicans in the Senate have challenged President Bush to report on his strategy for turning the Iraq conflict over to the Iraqis themselves. Meantime, the president is striking back at his critics by accusing Democrats of rewriting history. These developments are taking place against the background of polls showing that a majority of Americans believe they have been misled. On To the Point, will the dispute over how the war began ever be resolved? What's the impact on the broader war against terror? On Reporter's Notebook later on, politics and public broadcasting. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Olney, back with To the Point. As the president and his critics accuse each other of rewriting history, Americans are telling pollsters they were misled about going to war in Iraq. On To the Point, Republican senators are asking the White House how it plans to get out. What does it all mean for the war on terror? On Reporter's Notebook, the former chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is accused of breaking federal law and the organization's code of ethics. First, this news update. The Senate Banking Committee today approved Ben Bernanke to succeed Alan Greenspan at the Federal Reserve. Approval came by voice vote despite some concern about Bernanke's priorities. Greg Ipp covered the hearings for The Wall Street Journal. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Yes, hello, Warren.
There was one no vote to raise. That was Senator Bunning of Kentucky. What was his problem?
Well, Senator Bunning has basically been a thorn in the side of the Fed for a number of years now. He has opposed the renomination of Alan Greenspan as Fed chairman. And his attitude subsequent to that has been that anybody who agrees with Greenspan is somebody I can't agree with. And because Bernanke, when he was on the Fed, always agreed with Greenspan, that was bad enough for Bunning. But I will point out that Bunning didn't even attend the confirmation hearing yesterday, so one might infer from that that his opposition wasn't, you know, a very strong conviction.
So it would appear then that this nomination is on what they call a fast track for confirmation by the full Senate.
It's very hard to see any reason why it wouldn't go through, Warren. The Senate Majority Leader, Bill Frist, has said through his spokesman that they want to delay the full confirmation vote until January, the notion being that you don't want to have a fully confirmed new Fed chairman hanging around for too long while you already have a perfectly good chairman, Alan Greenspan, still in the job.
And the transition actually will occur when Greenspan retires in February, is that right?
Yes. Well, actually, Greenspan's last day on the job is January 31st, and if all goes according to plan, I presume Bernanke would be sworn in on February 1st.
All right. There were, though, some concerns raised by various senators having to do with inflation and unemployment. Why are those two words so important when you talk about the Federal Reserve?
Well, first, I think I ought to put this in perspective. It was a relatively smooth hearing, and while there was some consternation over this issue of whether the Fed ought to go the step of having a public numerical inflation target, I wouldn't want that to get in the way of the fact that there wasn't really much dispute at the Senate committee hearing over the fact that the Fed has done a pretty good job and that this is probably a small issue in the scheme of things. That said, one of the few areas where Bernanke differs from the monetary policy pursued by Alan Greenspan is that he doesn't think it's important enough just to aim for low inflation. He thinks that the Fed should put a number on it. And by putting a number on it, you can hold the Fed accountable for their job, and you can help guide expectations, and you might actually make the Fed more effective in terms of managing the economy. Now, the problem with an inflation target is that the Federal Reserve Act, which governs the Fed, says that it has two goals: low inflation and maximum employment. And there are those, and we saw this in the committee hearing yesterday, who fear that if the Fed were to have an inflation target, that this would subordinate their goal of trying to maximize employment. As Paul Sarbanes, who is the senior Democrat on the committee, said, "I'm afraid that if you have a target, a number for inflation, but not for unemployment, then all the focus will shift towards inflation." And Bernanke's response to this, and in fact the response of probably most economists, goes as follows. It's a false dichotomy to say that you have to have either low inflation or high employment. In fact, low inflation helps you achieve high employment because it makes the economy more efficient, it reduces booms and busts, and it means that companies and workers can focus on producing goods and services instead of trying to adjust for the effects of their eroding purchasing power.
Again, we're talking with Greg Ipp, economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Has anybody suggested setting a number for unemployment?
Well, oddly enough, Warren, there was once a number for unemployment. In 1978, they passed what became known as the Humphrey-Hawkins Act, which actually instructed the federal government and its associated agencies, including the Fed, to achieve unemployment of 4% and inflation of 3%. But in the event, it proved impossible to achieve both those things. There were just too many things going on in the economy. And the act was actually quietly allowed to expire in the year 2000. You know, despite the complaints we heard on the Hill yesterday, I think there is a broad acceptance in Congress nowadays that there are limits to what monetary policy can achieve. There are so many things that determine our unemployment rate. It's not just whether interest rates are high or low or the economy is strong or weak, but things like how well-educated the workforce is, whether we have structural barriers to people finding jobs and so on. Everything we've seen in terms of economic research and our own experience suggests that the best thing the Fed can do is trying to keep inflation low, and that's the biggest contribution it can make to high employment.
Well, you said that unlike Alan Greenspan, Mr. Bernanke does want to set a number for a target for inflation. What would the number be?
He has previously said he'd like a range of 1% to 2%, and currently we are actually looking at an inflation rate that's kind of near the top of that range. So if you were to think of him as coming to office next February and having that kind of target range in his mind, he might actually be a little bit worried that he's about to go through the top of the target, and maybe he'd come in with a few increases in interest rates to prevent that from happening.
So that's about as close as we'll get, I suppose, between now and February to any kind of prediction or indication of how Bernanke might act and how he might be different from Alan Greenspan.
Oh, absolutely, Warren. I mean, even if you had a target, which he doesn't now, and he promised that he would not be a bulldozer in terms of trying to force a target upon the Fed and the rest of us. But even if he had a target, he has made it clear that the interest rate actions he would pursue would not be governed by whether or not you were above or below the target right now, but what your forecast was. Are there forces underway in the economy that will move you back in the middle of the target or move you outside the target? And that is a very important and subtle distinction. It could be that by the time February rolls around that the economy might be weakening because of, for example, higher oil prices or lower housing prices.
All right. Obviously, much to be said there. Greg Ipp, as always, thanks a lot for being with us.
All right. Thanks for having me, Warren.
Economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal. In a moment, Truth and Falsehood and the War in Iraq on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Norman Alney back with To the Point. Recent polls show that a majority of Americans believe President Bush misled the country into the war in Iraq. Yesterday, the Republican Senate majority challenged the Bush White House to demonstrate that it has a strategy for turning the conflict over to the Iraqis and, of course, ultimately bringing American troops back home. Dana Milbank reports for The Washington Post. Always good to have you with us, Dana Milbank.
Hello, Warren.
Has this, do you think, shifted the debate about Iraq?
Well, it certainly shifted the politics. Arguably, what the Senate Republicans ultimately passed yesterday is what the president was likely to do anyway in terms of getting the bulk of forces out in 2006. But what it did, it was a defensive action by the Republicans in the Senate to prevent a more stringent Democratic measure from coming through. But it definitely is an expression of some concern there that the Senate Republicans are splitting from the White House here, and they're definitely increasing pressure on them. So while as it has no immediate policy impact, it definitely shows a change in the political culture and how this war is being viewed.
So it's a message then, at the very least, and one would assume that the Republicans are looking at those polls.
They certainly are. It's no accident that Lincoln Chafee, who's a vulnerable Republican up in Rhode Island, was joined with the Democratic version of that. Clearly, the president doesn't have to face election again, but a lot of these, a third of the Senate is up next year and the entire House, so they are finding more and more incentives to go their own way.
The president himself, before he left for Asia, attacked the Democrats and other critics of the war in Iraq and said they were rewriting history. How happy are the Republicans about that, that he's bringing back into public debate the argument over who misled who?
Well, as a general rule, they're pleased that he's fighting back, that he's giving more speeches on the questions of Iraq and terrorism in hopes that that'll boost some of his numbers here. He's been taken to account a bit for doing some rewriting of history on his own part. And then yesterday we had Chuck Hagel, a Republican senator, saying that it is absolutely the Democrats' right and responsibility to question Bush and the handling of the war. So they're by no means unified on that. But I think Republicans are generally pleased that the president is at least fighting back.
And, of course, the president himself, while saying that everybody has a right to disagree, said he thought that the way the Democrats were doing it by rewriting history, as he put it, they were being irresponsible. So Hagel was responding quite directly to what the president said.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, now Chuck Hagel is known as something of a gadfly who isn't afraid to take on the president, but it clearly was a sign. There's no mistaking that he was targeting Bush with that.
So you said that this has changed the political culture, suggesting there's a more broad concern going on than just the war in Iraq, but the relationship between the Congress and the White House. Elaborate a little bit on what you mean.
Well, for the past 5 years or so, the members of Congress in the House and in the Senate were afraid of the White House because the president was so popular, and they were pretty much lockstep in doing the bidding. Now, the president's popularity is down somewhere in the mid to upper 30s, which is extraordinarily low. You have Bill Frist in the Senate facing an SEC investigation. You have Tom DeLay forced to give up his leadership position in the House because of an indictment. And the result is sort of a free-for-all. The moderates feel free to go this way. The conservatives feel free to go this way. Nobody's following much discipline here. And there's definitely a sense that it's every man for himself.
And are they expecting that when the president comes back from Asia, he will be in any way able to take charge of the debate, to move them forward, to get them united as they look forward to the midterm elections coming up next year?
Well, he wasn't able to take charge before he left for Asia, so that by itself is not likely to change things. There's a long time between now and the elections next year, so if gas prices go down, if there's a large-scale withdrawal from Iraq, a number of other things could occur, and the president could be in a very different position right now. But at this moment, all of those trends seem to be working against him.
All right. Dana Milbank of The Washington Post is setting the political background for today's program. Thanks very much, as always, for joining us.
Thank you.
Once again, both sides now are accusing each other of rewriting history. This week on HuffingtonPost.com, James Fallows says that the argument misses what should be the essential criticism. Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. And James Fallows, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you very much, Warren.
What's the essential issue?
Well, it seems to me that I do understand the debate over who misled whom about what kind of information, but to my mind, that is less important than some other issues that so far the administration has not addressed and were not addressed in the president's speech. One, which does deal with this pre-war intelligence, is it somewhat disingenuous for the president to claim that everybody was working from the same set of data? It was very much the case during the pre-war buildup that the administration said, you know, if you knew what we knew, then you would be as concerned as we were. And so there was that kind of argument is essentially unanswerable when it's made by an administration because they do have access to information that other people can't claim to match. The other two points, just quickly, that I think it would be nice to have the administration address more directly than it has is that the next would be that even if you agree that Saddam Hussein might sooner or later have become a threat, even with nuclear weapons, that didn't mean the U.S. had to invade at the time it did. And indeed, many of the things that have proven problematic since the war could have been alleviated if the U.S. had had more time to build alliances, to have, you know, more plans for the occupation, et cetera. The final point is that the administration has never really addressed the fact that everything that's happened since the fall of Baghdad is its responsibility alone. everything about the occupation of Iraq is not something where it can share the responsibilities. These are decisions the administration made itself. So having an answer, a defense of the way it's managed the occupation would also be, I think, a contribution.
James Fallows, again, senior national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. We'll talk in a moment at length about what was said and who knew what before the war. But let me ask our next guest to address the last point here, that since the fall, since the invasion, only the administration is responsible for what has happened. Gary Schmidt is resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, director of their program on advanced strategic studies. He was executive director of President Reagan's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. And Gary Schmidt, it's always good to have you on our program.
Oh, thank you.
What about that point? Would you concede it, that what's happened in Iraq since the invasion was and is solely the responsibility of the president and the Republican Party?
Absolutely. Well, I don't know about the Republican Party.
Excuse me, not the Republican Party, the administration is what I...
No, I wouldn't disagree whatsoever. I think, and I've, you know, I wrote nearly 2 years ago that the administration was facing an insurgency, and a lot of the problems that they had in that insurgency they created by the way they handled post-Saddam planning. So I think a lot of the reasons for the disgruntlement today, both popular opinion-wise and also on the Hill, is directly attributable to the fact that I think they've done a fairly ham-handed job of post-Saddam nation building.
What about then the other point, or one of the other points James Fallows raised, and that is the timing of the invasion? Now, he says that with more time, many of the concerns that were expressed at the time of the invasion could have been alleviated. We wouldn't be in the mess we are now.
I tend to doubt it. I mean, one can debate this, I think. I mean, it's a fair debate. But the truth is, I in fact, if the inspections had gone on and the UN, you know, had not found anything, continued not to find anything, what would have happened, as best I can tell from the French policies and the Russian policies, is gradually the containment, which was already crumbling, would have crumbled further. And we know from the Kay and Duffler reports that Saddam was ready to restart his programs as soon as he could get out from under the sanctions. And I think that was a very likely, possibility. So, again, I think this is debatable. I mean, I don't think that it's unreasonable to raise this issue, but I don't think it's so clear that, in fact, we're heading a positive direction either, even if we had not gone to war then.
Gary Schmidt with the American Enterprise Institute. Back to James Fallows. Obviously, we're talking speculation and what-ifs here, but you did raise the issue and say that you thought many things could have been alleviated if more time had been given. What specifically did you mean?
So I should be clear. I'm not saying that things would necessarily or automatically have been better if there were more time taken, but here's what I had in mind in particular. There were two arguments the administration offered in those first couple of months of 2003 about why the time was right now. One was the kind of logistical argument. The troops were there. They were ready to go. You didn't want to have them fighting during the hot weather of summer, et cetera. And this struck me as a kind of pre-World War I guns of August argument. You know, the trains are moving towards the front, so let's just go ahead with the war. The other argument is similar to the one that Mr. Schmidt was just making, which is essentially we've waited for 12 years. If we don't sort of seize this political moment, it's likely that the coalition will erode. And that, I think, is a more respectable case for acting then. But as we look back on it, there are many things which with the right kind of attention, might have been better addressed had there been more time, in particular the chance of getting a broader alliance, including some Arabic-speaking or Islamic members. You know, it might not have happened, but if that had happened, many things would have been easier for the U.S. than they've proved to be.
What about France and Russia? Gary Schmidt mentioned them.
I don't know whether France might ever have been peeled off. It's hard for me to imagine the United States could not, with time, have found some way to make it in Russia's interest to acquiesce to this, not to be perhaps a member of the coalition, but to be peeled away from France.
So, Gary Schmidt, one of the criticisms has been that the coalition wasn't broad enough, particularly that it didn't include Arabic-speaking countries and countries that were neighbors of Iraq. What about that? Would that, do you think, have made it at least more acceptable to the rest of the world to invade Iraq?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it would have been, but I think it would have been virtually impossible actually to get the other countries like Jordan and certainly the Saudis involved in a real ground campaign. I mean, the the truth is, in the first Gulf War, we had a rare international occurrence where we had a massive consensus among all kinds of different kinds of states about stopping Saddam's conquest of Kuwait because it was so fundamental to the interest of a lot of those countries. Frankly, that just wasn't going to be seen. The second Gulf War wasn't going to be seen in the same light. I mean, at the end of the day, for example, the Saudis understood perfectly well that if Saddam was removed and the Americans were going to try to set up something of a democratic government in Iraq, it was going to be a government that was the majority of which was going to be Shia. So I think it would be extremely hard to get the Sunni Arab world involved in removing basically a Sunni despot from power.
James Fallows, you have a lengthy piece in the Atlantic Monthly current edition on the state of the army, the Iraqi army. The Joint Chiefs, Secretary Rumsfeld, the president himself keep saying that when they stand up, we'll stand down. What's the status of that, and could it have been in any way improved over what it is today?
Well, I think just as an intro to answering that, I think it's significant that Mr. Schmidt and I, from different perspectives on sort of the origins of the war, share the same conclusion that really the attention should be on why the post-fall of Baghdad occupation has been so mismanaged and whether there's any way out of that. And the current situation of the Iraqi army is sort of part of that chain of logic. The essential argument I came to believe after interviewing a very large number of people involved in training the Iraqi troops is that in the last 6 or 8 months, the effort of training the Iraqi army has improved. There, more troops are showing courage in battle, and the United States has figured out better ways to deal with them. But as they are improving, the surrounding security and insurgency situation is getting worse faster than the improvement. And so the gap between what has to be done and the ability of the Iraqis is actually increasing rather than decreasing. And so the evidence that I was privy to suggested that relying on an Iraqi force to transfer the security duties for is not going to be a reasonable option anytime soon, and the U.S. has to sort of adjust its policies to that reality.
By anytime soon, do you mean in the year 2006?
Yes, I would certainly mean that. And what the people with experience both in insurgency operations and counterinsurgency and also in the recent training efforts suggested that if the U.S. were serious about trying to develop an Iraqi force, this is a many, many years process. There's some things which the Iraqi army is not in the best circumstances going to have, for 5 or 6 years, the right kind of air operations, the right kind of intelligence operations, certain logistical support. And so if the U.S. is serious about this, it means a long-term commitment in the administration of the next president, whoever follows George Bush. And that's what it would take if we really think this is the way out of Iraq.
So, Gary Schmidt, to use a word that's currently in vogue, are the American people being misled about the prospects for the Iraqis taking over their own country?
I think initially, just as Mr. Fallows pointed out, I think there was a lot of happy talk in the first 2 years of after the fall of Baghdad about just what progress was being made in terms of training and getting those folks up. I mean, the folks I know in the field were quite clear that the training that was going on was very superficial and wasn't anything close to being what would be required to have a real capability on the Iraqis' part to handle an insurgency. I've argued that for a long time that there was the right war to do, but on the other hand, that this was going to be, a 5 to 10 year, engagement, and that the war can be won through proper counterinsurgency strategy, but it's certainly not a short-term event by any means.
Hold that point, if you will. James Fallows, will you also stay with us just for a couple of minutes after we take our break? Want to finish this conversation, then we'll move on to the question of the what was said and by whom and who thought what before the war ever began on Reporter's Notebook, Politics and Public Broadcasting. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Ollie back with To the Point, talking today about the war in Iraq, and just heard from James Fallows, senior correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly, that the argument over who rewrote history is probably less important than what's going on now and what's happened since the original invasion. But I want to go back to Gary Schmidt, again, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, director of the program there on advanced strategic studies, formerly with the Reagan Intelligence Advisory Board, on this question of if it's going to take 5 or 10 years for the Iraqis to take over. And it's a much more arduous and lengthy process than what you referred to as the happy talk we heard for the first couple of years. What about what's being said now by the administration and the Secretary of Defense, as well as the president himself, that giving the impression that there's going to be a pretty thorough takeover by the Iraqis before the end of next year?
I just don't think that's going to be possible, and I think that they're building themselves into a rhetorical trap that's actually quite dangerous. The president was at one point using rhetoric as the Iraqi stand up will stand down, and as I think Senator McCain and others have pointed out, that's just not the right way to approach it. That in fact, as the Iraqis stand up, they'll need our help for quite a while, and gradually, yes, they will begin to sort of take on more and more of the responsibilities for the fight against the insurgents. But the idea that we'll be, you know, as each Iraqi battalion seems to sort of march off the field, that we'll be pulling people out of Iraq, I think actually will raise false expectations that, either one of two things will happen. It'll be false expectations will have to be broken, or in fact we'll be pulling people out, in which case then I'm afraid we won't have a successful campaign against the insurgency.
And James Fallows with the Atlantic Monthly, I presume you would agree a rhetorical trap that's quite dangerous is represented by what's being said right now?
I agree, and this raises to me what is one of the most, what I think will be, from a historical perspective, one of the most perplexing and important mysteries of this whole era. And the mystery is why the people who were most committed to the necessity for this war. You know, I speak as somebody who was against the war at the beginning, but many people, you know, argue that it was necessary in America's long-term strategic interest. Why those same people did not take extraordinary care to make sure that the occupation went well? Because everything about the success of the vision depended on how the occupation went. And so the mystery to me, which historians will have to unravel, is why this gap, why this lassitude, why these rhetorical traps are now being created. And I don't have an explanation.
James Fallows, again, senior national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly, should have added a former speechwriter for Jimmy Carter and author of Breaking the News, How the Media Undermine American Democracy. As always, good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Gary Schmidt, resident scholar of the American Enterprise Institute, is still with us. I want to introduce now David Korn, Washington editor of The Nation, liberal magazine, of course, also author of a book called The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception. David Korn, welcome back to our program.
Good to be with you, Warren.
Our earlier guests seem to agree that the question of who said what to whom and who's rewriting history is less important than this ongoing issue about the occupation. But you've written a good deal about the rewriting of history. The president now says that it's the Democrats that are doing the rewriting. Where do you come down on that, and where has the president been rewriting history?
Well, the president has been talking about apples and oranges. He came out with a speech on Friday saying that those people who have accused him of having overstated the intelligence and saying that it was more certain than it was, for instance, he said before the war that the intelligence contained no doubt, that's a quote, no doubt about Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. He said, you know, that critics who have leveled these charges, you know, are not taking into account that the Senate Intelligence Committee report says that there was no political pressure applied by the administration on intelligence analysts. Now, this is apples to oranges, because that's a separate issue, and Democrats actually dissented from the report and came up with examples of there having being pressure. But putting that aside, Bush has refused to acknowledge that he, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, again and again and again, before the war, came out and said there was no doubt. And they also said things that the intelligence, as flawed as it was, didn't even say. For instance, Bush in Cincinnati in 2002, in a very key speech, said that Iraq had stockpiles of biological weapons. The bad reporting that the CIA had put out said that Iraq had a biological weapons R&D program. Now, there's a big difference between the R&D program and stockpiles. The president came out and said time and time again that Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein were in cahoots with each other, even though the reporting from the CIA and others didn't back that up. So the question remains, you know, as bad as the intelligence was and all the problems with the intelligence, why did the president and his key administration officials come out and say, we know for sure. Donald Rumsfeld said at one point in time, we know where the nuclear weapons are. Condoleezza Rice said, we know these aluminum tubes, the infamous aluminum tubes, could only be used for nuclear weapons, even though intelligence analysts were arguing amongst each other if that was true or not. And so it's the degree of certainty that they put on the intelligence in describing it to the public, which they obviously did to build support for the war, and that is something that the president and his advisors have yet to contend with and to talk about honestly.
David Korn, the Washington editor of The Nation. Back to Gary Schmidt at the American Enterprise Institute. The president, the Secretary of Defense, and others have been quoting from Democrats, members of the Clinton administration, President Clinton himself, Secretary of State, former Secretaries of State as well, saying that, in fact, they thought that Saddam Hussein either did or would have weapons of mass destruction, that he was a threat to the United States. Was there, though, despite those quotes, some disagreement among the intelligence community, as David Korn says, that wasn't shared with the American people?
Well, I think people should take a look at exactly what's available, which is both the Senate Intelligence Committee report and also the Rob Silverman report, but also they can actually go and find the National Intelligence Estimate that was published and what it contains. And the dissents that Mr. Korn's talking about, in fact, are there, but they're not particularly highlighted. That's true. But on the other hand, they weren't particularly changed the overall assessment that, by the way, the dissenters also agreed with, which is that Saddam had these weapons, that he had these programs, and that, in fact, he was interested in reconstituting his nuclear weapons program. People should go take a look for themselves. The Bush administration's rhetoric, as somebody has actually gone back and looked very thoroughly at the Clinton administration's own rhetoric about Saddam and Iraq, and particularly in 1998, and looked at the Bush administration rhetoric, you'd be very hard-pressed to find a dime's worth of difference. As a matter of fact, in certain instances, the Clinton administration was, in fact, even more certain about the weapons and also a little bit more hyperbolic in its presentation. The famous Secretary of Defense Bill Cohen showing up on ABC with a bag of sugar saying, well, this much sugar could wipe out all of Washington, D.C., and that's what Saddam has by the truckloads. Another person in the administration, I think it was Madeleine Albright, referred to Saddam as a clear and present danger. That, by the way, is not anything the Bush administration or the president himself said in any of his major speeches.
So, David Korn, back to you. Who's rewriting history here if the Democrats, in fact, said all those things?
Well, no one denies the Democrats say that. Now, the key thing here, there are a couple of points here. One point is that citing intelligence or hyping intelligence, if that's what the Clinton administration did, is different than going to war on the basis of bad intelligence. And this is a way of the Bush administration just not acknowledging its responsibility. They've yet to say, we went to war because we did not see through the bad intelligence. Our mistake. Sorry about that. And the other point is, and this is up on my blog today, I'll just promote it because people want to go look at it, davidkorn.com. In 1998, when Clinton, these quotes that come from Bill Clinton, these were quotes that he was putting out to justify a bombing raid, which the Clinton people will tell you got rid of what perhaps remained of the very little weapons of mass destruction infrastructure that was left in Iraq. And so at that point in time, Bill Clinton was citing these reports, but he thought, well, what we should do on the basis of these reports is have a limited bombing attack, and guess what? It worked. There, you know, whatever remained, if anything remained, was gone. So quoting Bill Clinton in 1998 has nothing to do with Bush's decision in 2003 to go to war. I mean, that's what I understand why they want to spin it that way. I understand why they want to, you know, muddy up the waters that way. But the bottom line still remains that there was an active debate on a lot of the key points on the intelligence. Condoleezza Rice got memos sent to her about the dispute over the aluminum tubes. Yet she still came out and said, it's beyond dispute that these tubes mean he's building nuclear weapons. And, while there has been the Rob Silverman report and the Senate Intelligence Committee report, both took a complete pass on looking at this part of the process, looking at the intelligence that was produced and how the administration presented it to the American public and whether they went too far in what they said. And I have yet to see anyone come up with a good explanation of how the president could say that Iraq had stockpiles of biological weapons when the CIA, in a report which turns out to be wrong, said that at best they had an R&D program.
So, Gary Schmidt, back to you then. What about it? Were there rhetorical traps, to use your phrase from earlier, being laid before the war? Go ahead.
Just a couple of points. Mr. Corn keeps talking about the aluminum tubes and the dissents. Well, the dissents were there by INR and by the Department of Energy, and you can go find those in the National Intelligence Assessment.
So, in other words, the dissenting comments were not taken out?
No. And the second thing, and they were available to the members of Congress and all the senior officials in the government.
Well, we certainly didn't hear about them from Condoleezza Rice or
My second point is simply that then if you go look at the people that were dissenting on the aluminum tubes, they did not dissent from the overall judgment that Saddam Hussein was interested and was developed and had a program up and running vis-a-vis nuclear weapons. So in other words, even though there was dissent over this particular issue, the general assessment shared by all the intelligence community was that he was still in the business of trying to create nuclear weapons. So, this dissent is important, but it's misleading to suggest that somehow that the intelligence community wasn't on the same page. Now, on this issue of what the Clinton administration said in 98 and then the bombing, Mr. Corn has no clue whether or not, and the Clinton administration has no clue whether or not the bombing actually took out what remained of Saddam's weapons programs. It might have, it might have not. What I would just point out is that while those quotes in 98 are certainly they're on the record, it's also the case that many of the senior officials in the Clinton administration, people from the NSC, the vice president, and the president, all spoke after 98 about the problems of Saddam's weapons programs in very much the same vein. In particular, one NSC official in charge of Iraq, Ken Pollack, specifically was at a meeting in 2002 in which there was both Clinton administration officials and also people on the Republican side, and there was universal agreement that Saddam was in the business of trying to create nuclear weapons and that he had a nuclear weapons program. So it's just not 98 bombing and it stops. There was agreement from 98 all the way through 2002 from both sides of the aisle and, frankly, from the international community as a whole.
Gary Schmidt, back to your point about intelligence and the agreement amongst intelligence organizations that Saddam Hussein was trying to reconstruct his weapons of mass destruction or had the intention of doing that. That's very different from saying that he's a clear and present danger, whether it comes from Madeleine Albright or from the Bush administration, as they are planning, as David Korn pointed out, to go to war. So, again, the question becomes, was there a hyping of intelligence in order to justify the war?
No, I don't think so at all. The intelligence communities, both here and abroad, all assumed that he had weapons programs, which, by the way, he still did. But he didn't have the key issue is he didn't have stockpiles. The reason why the stockpiles issue is so important is because up and through the beginning of the war, the UN reports kept consistently saying that there were these massive amounts of there were issues like anthrax and some other things that still Iraq had not resolved, that Iraq's own papers, internal papers, indicated that he had a certain amount of these things, like 2,000, 20,000 liters, whatever it was, of VX. It's not the U.S. that was saying that these things were outstanding. It was the U.N. reports themselves, including Hans Blix's report of even as late as May 2003. So the issue of hyping, the stockpiles, in fact, is based upon what the UN itself said was outstanding. Saddam had an obligation to come clean, and for a variety of reasons, apparently, he didn't. So I don't think the intelligence was hyped. I think, in fact, obviously it was wrong, but on the other hand, I don't think there was any intent on anybody's part to deceive or to mislead.
So, David Korn, pretty important distinction, honest mistake or a deception?
No. Donald Rumsfeld said, we know where the weapons of mass destruction are. He said, we know where they are. Did he know where they are? where they were? No, he didn't. So why could he? How could he say that? On the UN, the UN report said that there were that they had unaccounted for reports, not unaccounted for documents about past stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. Hans Blix said over and over again, and he was the head of the UN inspectors, that doesn't mean that they have these weapons, but we have accounting issues that we're trying to get them to work out and resolve with us. Until we resolve these, we can't say that there's nothing there. So they weren't saying that there was something there. He was saying there were issues to resolve, but we do know the International Atomic Energy Agency, you know, weeks before the war, Mohammed Al-Baradei, who just won the Nobel Peace Prize, they concluded after being back in, remember, inspectors were there, they were going to these sites, they were going to the sites that Colin Powell had pointed out during his speech, they were finding nothing. And weeks before the invasion, the IAEA came up with a conclusion that they had no evidence. They found nothing to suggest that Saddam Hussein had revived his nuclear weapons program.
Okay, Gary Schmidt, your comment on that.
Well, you know, do we depend upon IAEA inspectors who, you know, previously had found that there was no nuclear weapons program in Iraq, but then it turns out in 1991, after the war, we discovered that Saddam was anywhere from 6 months to a year away from having a nuclear weapon. So, you know, having U.S. security in the hands of, you know, Al-Baradei, judgment isn't something that the American people were going to stand for. Here was a dictator who had plenty of weapons of mass destruction in the past, had used them, was frustrating even Hans Blix in his efforts to try to account for what the Iraqis themselves had papered as stockpiles. So I think the judgment after 9/11 is that with that kind of history, both the weapons use and weapons programs and Saddam's own behavior, this was not something that we were going to tolerate, and I think the president made the right decision. Now, it turns out that the intelligence was wrong, but on the other hand, the history of Saddam and his weapons programs made that a reasonable judgment at the time.
All right. The argument goes on. We thank you both for being with us. Gary Schmidt, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, formerly with the Reagan administration's Intelligence Advisory Board, and David Korn, Washington editor of The Nation, author of The Lies of George W. Bush, whose website is davidkorn.com. Thanks to our earlier guests, James Fallows of The Atlantic Monthly and Dana Milbank of The Washington Post as well. Good to have all of you on our program today, and we'll, of course, deal with these issues on future programs as well. Meantime, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting says it'll try to strengthen public confidence after a scathing report by its own inspector general. Former CPB chairman Kenneth Tomlinson is accused of breaking federal law in his effort to put more conservatives on the air. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Former Chairman Kenneth Tomlinson resigned from the board of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting 2 weeks ago after word got out that Inspector General Kenneth Kahns would be highly critical. The Kahns report, released yesterday, portrays Tomlinson as a rogue appointee who often exceeded his authority. That's according to Matea Gold in today's Los Angeles Times. Matea, good to have you back with us.
Oh, good to be with you, Warren.
What kinds of laws and regulations is Mr. Tomlinson accused of having broken?
Well, the Inspector General really found three categories of violations. Most seriously, he found that Mr. Tomlinson broke federal law, specifically the Public Broadcasting Act, in two different occasions, one in which he was promoting the creation of a program called the Journal Editorial Report, which features the conservative editorial page editors of the Wall Street Journal, and he was very involved in getting that on the air in PBS, despite the fact that CPB officials are not allowed to be involved in programming. He also found...
That was the violation then, that he was involved in getting that program on, even though the law says that's not the role of somebody on the board?
Exactly. There's an explicit language in the Public Broadcasting Act that forbids public CPB official from being involved in the creation and the direction of programming.
Okay.
And there also, the Public Broadcasting Act also forbids the use of political tests in hiring, which the Inspector General found a lot of evidence that likely occurred when Mr. Tomlinson was advocating for the hiring of the new president of the corporation, Patricia Harrison, who is a former Republican Party co-chairwoman. There were also evidence.
And before you go on, political tests. What kind of evidence was there that Tomlinson applied political tests with regard to Patricia Harrison?
Well, the inspector general cited what he called some cryptic emails between Tomlinson and White House officials, including Karl Rove. They did not release the emails, so we have not had a chance to peruse them ourselves, but the inspector general indicated that they supported the notion that Tomlinson was considering politics in his search for a new president.
So again, then, the inspector general says there's evidence, but he hasn't brought it forward to the public.
Exactly. We haven't seen the emails.
Okay.
He said they released to the full board, but we've not seen copies of them ourselves.
All right. Now, you said there was a third category of violations.
Well, two other categories. Those are both violations of the Public Broadcasting Act.
Oh, okay.
Then, generally, he found multiple occasions in which Tomlinson violated the CPB's contracting procedures by hiring consultants and lobbyists without getting approval from the rest of the board. And then he also found violations of some of these same instances violated the CPB's ethical guidelines.
And in what way did he violate ethical guidelines?
Well, specifically, I guess the ethics cover issues like promoting the programming when he wasn't really supposed to be doing that, communicating with White House officials about things that were political, basically the same kinds of violations. But
same acts, but different violations.
Exactly.
And with regard to consultants and lobbyists, what are the details on that?
Well, we had heard already before this report came out several instances in which Mr. Tomlinson had hired people or put out contracts, given contracts to people to try to pursue this goal he had, which he termed was to bring more balance to public broadcasting. Specifically, he brought on board a consultant who he asked to monitor guests on several public broadcasting programs, including Now with Bill Moyers, and the inspector general indicated that one of the goals of that audit was actually to prove to PBS that the Moyer show was liberal and unbalanced. He found that that contract had been given without really following contracting procedures. Similarly, Mr. Tomlinson hired two ombudsmen to monitor content without considering other candidates, and there were several other instances like that.
Again, we're talking with Matea Gold, who covers television and the media, as well as other things, for the Los Angeles Times. Did the inspector general go to the merits of the charge that public broadcasting is, in fact, more liberal than it is conservative?
Well, no. Interestingly, Warren, he did not address that central premise, nor did he come to any conclusions about whether Tomlinson was seeking to remake this institution into a conservative entity, which is what many critics have charged. Tomlinson has consistently maintained that he has only sought to bring balance to what he has said is a liberal slanted system, and the inspector general did not conclude that he was trying to, in fact, just fill the public broadcasting with conservatives. He didn't really come down either way on that.
In other words, he didn't address the issue. It's not that he said that didn't happen. He didn't choose to speak to it.
The report doesn't address that. In an interview afterwards, I asked him about it. He said he did not find evidence that Tomlinson was seeking to remake public broadcasting into a conservative entity.
Is that a surprising conclusion, given the kinds of evidence that you've just enumerated?
Well, in some ways, I think that kind of conclusion might be beyond the scope of the inspector general. He was specifically looking at whether rules and federal laws were violated, which he focused on. I think it's probably another step whether to interpret what Mr. Tomlinson's motivations were, which, frankly, only he knows. And that's something that congressional Democrats are still pursuing, as well as public broadcasting advocates. They say that this proves to them that there was an effort to try to make this into a conservative institution, and they plan to continue asking questions about it.
Meantime, then, what about those who remain on the board, including and also the president of the corporation, Patricia Harrison, with all of her former Republican ties? What are they saying about all this?
Well, it's a very tricky time for them. Mr. Tomlinson resigned from the board two weeks ago. There apparently was a legal document signed in which everyone agreed not to really discuss his tenure and his acts. So they have been rather silent on specifically discussing what he did and what the inspector general found he did. Cheryl Halperin, the new chair of the board, called the inspector general's findings bracing, and Patricia Harrison spoke at length yesterday with reporters about the need to repair what she called a rip in trust in the system. So there is a strong acknowledgement, I think, from the officials who still remain there that they're going to have to do a lot of work to try to regain trust for CPB right now.
And what is Mr. Tomlinson saying about what has been said about him?
Well, he declined to speak and give interviews, but he did release a statement with the report. He called the charges malicious and irresponsible. He accused the Inspector General of having an agenda, which Cons denied, and said that he disputed basically all of these allegations.
How does Cons get to be Inspector General of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting?
He appears to be someone who's been in this position for a while. I believe he was also an Inspector General at the EPA, and so has a long history doing these kinds of investigations.
And is Tomlinson now, having resigned as chair of the board and from the board itself, involved in any way in public broadcasting?
He's not involved in domestic public broadcasting, but interestingly, he still retains his position as chair of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is a very powerful federal agency that regulates the U.S. broadcasts abroad, including Voice of America, efforts to broadcast in Arabic and around the world. There is an actual investigation into his tenure there by the Inspector General of the State Department, if you can follow all this, looking into allegations that he may have had ghost employees or have had some financing problems over there. So that's something we're also going to be keeping an eye on.
Any comment from the White House? President appointed Mr. Tomlinson.
The White House has declined to comment. Yesterday they just noted that Tomlinson is no longer on the CPB board, and they also declined to give interviews to the Inspector General, saying it was out of his jurisdiction to interview White House officials.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Matea Gold covers television and media for the Los Angeles Times. Today's program produced by Jonah King with Francis Anderton and Katie Cooper, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.